was the vice chair. He's here to do that.
Signed on to everything.
Don't worry about
it. We convene the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Today is Tuesday, February 28th. I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2576. And we don't have Representative Rayfield, but I do have Jock Mills, Scott Beckstead, and Brian somebody? Me?
Not you.
Oh, different Brian. So come on up and tell us about this bill.
Okay.
Just have you all at once. We'll make it quicker. Okay.
Good morning.
Morning.
Members of the committee, Chair Clem, I'm Jock Mills. I'm the Director of Government Relations at Oregon State University. I'm here before you actually representing the interest of all of the public universities, in particular the University of Oregon and Oregon State Universities, because we're the ones who have collections and operate under the ballot measure that was passed in the fall and has an effect on us. So that's why I'm here. I just want to make clear to you this is not just about OSU. It's about multiple institutions. With the passage of the measure this fall, prior to the passage of the measure, we approached the Humane Society. They were gathering signatures, and we indicated we may have some concerns with regard to the way this envelops some of the activities we undertake. It was too late. The signatures were being gathered. It was really impossible to go back and alter the measure as it was proposed and voted on. And we really did not engage. We didn't think it was one of those things that was something we'd be able to have an effect. And so we basically let the measure pass without engaging in the process. Once the measure passed, we approached Representative Rayfield and indicated we're looking for some technical changes. Would you be interested in sponsoring a bill? And he obliged, and we drafted a bill aimed at two variables. There's two variables that play that affect us and that are involved with this bill. One is the technical definition of species. We had a number of concerns about the way that definition worked. The other was the way the exemption was written. Both of these were different from the measure that passed in the state of Washington. So that's kind of where we came from. We looked at the Washington measure and thought it was more effective, for at least not less disruptive in terms of the work that we were doing. We drafted the bill. After the bill was drafted, we reached out to the Humane Society. Our interest was basically threading the needle and getting these technical changes accomplished in a way that wouldn't keep the bill from having the intended effect that the Humane Society wished to have with the passage of the measure. So we were very clear with the Humane Society, we don't want to gut and stuff the measure. We're really trying to take care of a very narrow window. Once we got into those discussions, we discovered that our efforts to redefine the species was extremely problematic. And we said, okay, let's deal with the exemptions, because if you adequately provide the exemptions to the research institutions that are actively involved with this, whatever problems we have with the definition of the species goes away, because we're exempted from whatever problems we may be having with the exemption, with the definition of the species. And so that's where we are today. We have been working over the last, since December, in earnest since the session began, with the Humane Society. My sense is that we have I's to dot and T's to cross on amendment language, which we hope we can bring forward to you in very soon, that would amend this bill. The essence of those amendments would be basically to strip the provisions that redefine the species and come in with a cleaner definition of what the exemption and to whom the exemption applies and how it works. That's the basics of the testimony I wanted to provide to you. I have Dr. Sidlauskas with me, who can go through, in essence, the way we operate or what we're doing, so that you get a sense of what it is we're trying to protect and trying to deal with this bill. And if you have no questions for me, or later if you have questions, I'm happy to hand it over to Brian.
Yeah, tell us what it is you do. I have no idea, and I can't even guess, actually. So
happy to do so. I can introduce myself first. My name is Brian Sidlauskas. I'm an associate professor at Oregon State University, and I'm also the curator of the Oregon State Ichthyology Collection, which is a library of biodiversity in Corvallis. It's got about 250,000 preserved fishes in it, and we're one of the natural history collections in the state. There are several others at Oregon State University. There are also natural history collections at the University of Oregon, at Portland State, at Willamette, and probably several of the other institutions. We're an educational and research facility, and we provide specimens going back 100 years all the way to the present of a variety of species that occur throughout Oregon and throughout the world. These specimens exist in order for students to study them and also for researchers to do various types of analyses on the morphology, genetics, biodiversity of animals throughout Oregon and throughout the planet. We have a number of species in the collection that would be covered by the bill, and we often exchange these in various ways with other similar institutions. There are more than 100 similar institutions throughout the country and many more than that throughout the world. Sometimes we loan them, sometimes we gift them, but often we exchange them. We'll make trades and say we have a fairly large number of a species that is common here in Oregon that have been donated to us. We will perhaps trade those with a collection that's on the East Coast in order to enhance their holdings and to enhance ours. That would allow us to have, for example, specimens of a common species of shark that occurs in the Atlantic in exchange for a commoner species of shark that occurs in the Pacific, and these students on both sides of the country benefit. As currently written, my understanding is that this legislature would prohibit the ability for us to trade these specimens, and that is probably the most common or the most important way in which there would be a wrench thrown into our particular works. Another thing that happens at the university that might potentially be of interest, if I should talk about the whales, is that good? For example, many professors at the university are involved in using genetic information to determine population structure, to identify unknown material. A prominent case of this had to do with our Marine Mammal Institute several years ago, identifying pieces of meat that was potentially whale meat purchased overseas and doing genetic testing on that material to determine what species these samples had essentially come from. In order to obtain those samples, they needed to purchase them from markets, and this would be prohibited under the current legislature, as far as I understand. That is probably enough for me, but I should give you an idea of what's happening.
Okay. Any questions for these two? Explanation. Okay, Scott, tell us what you're worried about.
Thank you. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States. The Humane Society of the United States was a lead organization in the coalition that worked to pass Measure 100. And I think Jock did a really outstanding job of sort of giving the history and the context of our efforts to work together. You'll notice I put down that I'm opposed to the bill. I'm only opposed to the bill as written. The amendments that we've discussed, we are, in full support of, to the extent that it will accomplish the ability of Dr. Sidlauskas and others to engage in their work. The provision of the bill regarding the list of species is something that we would be absolutely opposed to. So we're only opposed to the bill as written, and we're waiting to see these amendments, but assuming they say what we think they're going to say, then we would be in support.
Okay. Any questions for Scott? So I, like many people, probably didn't read the entire ballot measure. I probably looked at the summary statement or something like that. Is the list that's in here on page 2 of the bill where it talks about tigers, lions, leopards, cheetahs, was that all new from the ballot measure, or was that existing law even before that?
Chair Clem, no, that list is part of the ballot measure.
Okay. And so, again, I know you're not going to get into it, but just for my own curiosity, was the point that, you know, there's a many different types of lions, and so lion might be like Africa lion, but it also could be a mountain lion, or I don't even know what other kinds of lions there are. But
I'd be happy to take that question. The area where this is perhaps the most ambiguous concerns the fishes that are on the list, sharks and rays. There are more than 600 species of sharks in the world.
And Chair Clem, I would add that the reason we oppose the amendment is because it refers to CITES and the Schedule 1 and Schedule 2 list of endangered and threatened species under CITES, uh-huh. which CITES is a political body. So just because a particular animal or species isn't listed in CITES does not mean it's imperiled. And so from an enforcement angle, imagine, if you will, you know, someone is selling shark teeth necklaces from a street side, you know, flea market in Lincoln City. For an enforcement officer, whether it's an ODFW official or someone else, to determine whether or not it's from a prohibited species, you would have to either be Dr. Sidlauskas or you would have to do some sort of technical laboratory analysis to find out if it's covered or not. So we, you know, the voters, you know, knew what they were voting on, and from an enforcement standpoint, and just for, you know, purposes of preserving the wishes of the voters, we would want to keep that list the way it is. The other thing that I would say, though, is that ODFW is going to have to go into the rulemaking process, and in that rulemaking process, the ballot measure specifically allows ODFW to enact rules that make enforcement easier, and if there's any potential for confusion, for example, between mammoth ivory and African elephant ivory, then ODFW can work with this list to make the enforcement more effective. So that process still has to happen.
Mr. Chair, may yeah. I just, I'm sorry to parse words, but Scott, you said the reason you'd oppose the amendment, what you were actually meaning to say was the reason you opposed the bill, that's why you want the amendment to get these those problematic
yeah.
provisions out of it.
Sorry, it's, that's okay. It was an early morning for me this morning.
No worries. Okay, any other questions for these gentlemen?
This may sound really silly, but when I'm looking at the list, and it's elephant, rhinoceros, whale, tiger, lion, could you sweep sea lion into this under this definition?
Representative Clem and Chair McEwen, these are taxa. The list of different types of animals are taxa. So. Cougars or mountain lions are in a different, they're both in the cat family, but they're a different genus. And certainly sea lions are in the pinniped family. They're not even part of the same taxa. So
it does say lion, so could that assumption be made or no?
I don't believe that would be an interpretation of the measure that would pass muster.
Okay, any further questions? Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then, Chris Marley, are you here on this bill? Okay, just want to make sure. Please come on up. Watched that earlier. I should have put him with that one. Scott, second one.
My name is Chris Marley. I appreciate the opportunity to express how this bill and this measure would impact my business. And frankly, there's a number of businesses that would be dramatically and negatively impacted by this measure the way it is written. It was purported to be modeled after Washington State's 1401, I believe. And Washington State's measure tied the definition of the species to the IUCN Red List. And the IUCN is the oldest conservation organization in the world. It is the authoritative body out of which CITES, which is the Convention on the International Trade of Endangered Species, grew out of. And CITES is truly a political and a law enforcement arm around the world for endangered species. My concern is also with sharks and rays. There are over 500 species of sharks, over 600 species of rays, of which CITES lists 12 of each that are endangered or threatened, and the IUCN lists a few more, up to about 40 of each. And so that leaves us with over 1,000 common fish around the world that for whatever reason, there is a wholesale ban on suddenly in the state of Oregon, which is problematic in many ways, again, for my business and many others. The other problem that I have is that it was mentioned that Oregon voters knew what they were voting on with Measure 100. I stridently disagree. Measure 100 was advertised exclusively as a measure to protect the trafficking of endangered or threatened species. And here we have less than 10% of the species that are affected by this measure are actually endangered or threatened, according to CITES and the IUCN Red List. It is, in my opinion, egregious that we would take such draconian measures in Oregon to take common fish species and suddenly, because they have the same common name as an endangered or a threatened species, make a wholesale ban on this state. It makes no sense. And so, once again, if we were to truly model our law after other West Coast laws of a similar nature, we would, as they have, tie the species in a scientific way to the IUCN Red List or to CITES, and then there would be a consistent monitoring of the status of these species. And whenever a status is admitted by either the IUCN Red List or CITES, then that species would be banned in Oregon. Otherwise, we are taking two super orders of fish that I don't know that this has ever happened anywhere in the world, and simply banning them wholesale because they sound like, or they're a cool-looking fish, or they sound like another fish that is endangered. And this is not scientifically based.
Okay, and what type of business do you do?
There's no easy way to explain what I do. I basically I go around the world and I look for beautiful natural artifacts. And we create, I have a business and I have, with a studio here in Salem and then one in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And we make artwork that incorporates natural artifacts, animal, vegetable, mineral of all kind. We work. And I've never, I don't know anything about state regulations or governments. Honestly, we work exclusively with U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And so I know I'm very familiar with federal regulations because anything we import, of course, has to have export permits and import permits. And we're very familiar with CITES and IUCN. Sure. And so, but I've been fortunate enough to work with the most exclusive retailers in America and around the world, with some of the biggest institutions and museums we're working with now, top 10 natural history museums in the world, and we do some very beautiful work. And everything that we do personally with regards to vertebrates is all reclaimed organisms. So they come from importers or zoos or museums or quarantine facilities. When organisms die of natural causes, we swoop in, buy them, and make something beautiful out of them. So we're not killing any vertebrates, but we believe that we should have the right to be able to make something lasting and something beautiful that will inspire generations out of organisms that die of natural causes in captivity.
Interesting. I'm looking at your website. Okay. Any other questions for Chris? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you do you envision an amendment that might address your problem?
Yeah, actually, there's the issue that I didn't talk about. There's another issue that is vague with regards to Measure 100, and that is that the exemption that when the activity is expressly authorized by federal law, we don't know if that means that if we have, you know, authorization from U.S. Fish and Wildlife, they clear a shipment for us, if that means that it's expressly authorized by federal law. So that's one issue that I wanted to address. But we really don't deal with hardly any CITES species ever. And so if we are able to, as House Bill 2576 states, if we are able to tie the list of covered species to CITES or to the IUCN Red List, then we wouldn't have a problem at all. We would just continue to work with common species that are unprotected and unthreatened and endangered.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2576. and open a public hearing on House Bills 2533 and House Bill 2535. Ask our colleague, Representative Reardon, resident B guy in the Capitol, to come join us. And did you want Jenny to come up? Yeah, Jenny, can you join us?
2535.
2533 and 2535, we'll just do them together.
I'll do both.
At least for the purposes of Representative Reardon, so he can get back to other things. Okay, tell us about 25, well, whatever you'd like to, but I see testimony on 25. Oh, no, you have it on both. Tell us about both.
Yeah, I do. Good morning. I'm Representative Jeff Reardon, District 48, and very happy to be here this morning. I was on this committee when I first arrived at the Capitol a couple of sessions ago, and you guys have the greatest topics, so it's really exciting to be back. Sometime between getting elected in 2012 and actually arriving here, there was a great bee kill-off in Wilsonville, a couple other places, and I ended up becoming the bee guy, I guess is my official title. And so I had a bill that student told that it would not go anywhere, okay. That ended up becoming a task force in 2014. We came up with a number of different outcomes from the task force, and it talked about establishing a diagnostic facility at Oregon State, wanted to implement some educational materials to help people understand about the issues around pollinators, established a reporting system to report when there were die-offs, and then also increase the apiary registrations fees to help fund some of the pollinator health related services. So it was a matter of industry helping fund some of the work that they identified as needing to be done. So anyway, so in 2015 we did a bill that did all of that and implemented the funding and so forth. There was one little error in rulemaking, however, that came up, and that's all we want to do with this bill is try to correct that error. And who knew that there were two different types of colonies, bee colonies. So there's a pollinator colony and a nucleus colony. The intent of the bill was to get a little bit of a fee off of production hives, which are the pollinator colonies, but they don't make anything off of nucleus colonies, and that's just kind of like part of the operation. So we just want to make a small correction, and that's what the bill would do on that. So I don't know if, Jenny, do you want to add anything to that? Or?
Thank you. Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler. I'm with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. The only piece I will add to that, because Representative Reardon and I know that the Oregon State Beekeepers Association are both going to speak very eloquently to this fix, is just that we heard from our beekeepers that the financial burden that one technical issue was going to pose in House Bill 2533 was going to be a pretty significant regulatory burden that a lot of the smaller beekeepers and even some of the larger ones were going to have to bear. And so their request was just, you know, can you help us get this technical fix? We agreed to a fee on these production colonies, but with regard to the nucleus colonies, a lot of them aren't even going to survive beyond their initial stages. So that's how we got involved and worked with Representative Reardon, and I think we felt really good about the Dash One amendment that was drafted to get us there. So.
Okay, so that's 2533.
Correct.
Exempting nucleus colonies from this registration.
Right.
Fee reduction. Or fee exemption, I guess would be the right term.
We prefer to think of it as a correction. Correcting.
Some people like reducing fees. We may raise one here and there. Like, we need an offset. Okay, what else we got?
Okay, on House Bill 2535, the subject is noxious weeds. And they're destructive, very competitive with other plants, very difficult to control. And they really are a threat to agriculture, native flora and fauna, and so forth. And they're just downright irritating. I think when I think of this, I think of Scotch broom in the summertime, which just
makes me ill, actually, but and you don't care. But the detrimental impacts of these invasive plants far outweigh their value as a pollen and nectar source. So they actually estimated to cost Oregon's economy about $83 million a year, and that's according to Katie Fast, who's executive director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter, an agribusiness group. So I'm introducing this bill to create a four-year pilot program that would simply replace the noxious weeds with regular non-invasive forage plants that offer benefits to the pollinators. So we don't want those little guys to go hungry, but we want to get rid of these invasive weeds. And there's another bill that's kind of related to this. It's House Bill 2043 that would provide funding to carry out the Oregon Department of Agriculture's noxious weed program over the next biennium. So they'll be working on, ODA would be working on that. This would, this particular bill, 2535, would require the ODA to conduct a four-year pilot program to replace noxious weeds that supply pollen and nectar to pollinating insects with non-invasive forage plants. So that's really all there is to it, except there's always more to it than that, and I'll turn it over to the expert, if I may.
All right. Thank you again, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Again, Jenny Dressler from Oregon Farm Bureau for the record. We got great background from Representative Reardon on House Bill 2535. There's companion legislation in the Senate, Senate Bill 814, which does the exact same thing. I believe that the representative is also a chief co-sponsor of that legislation. Farm Bureau actually brought this bill to Representative Reardon, last fall, and it was after a pretty robust discussion in the Washington State Legislature around similar legislation. I think that was House Bill 2478, which passed almost unanimously in the Washington Legislature, looking at how we can further reduce the spread of noxious weeds while considering ways to support pollinator populations with regard to forage. When we saw that that bill had passed, Farm Bureau went to the Department of Agriculture, Oregon State University Extension, and the Oregon State Beekeepers Association and said, you know, this seems like it was a really good step to support pollinator populations. What are the needs of the industry? What are the needs of native pollinators with regard to forage and malnutrition issues? And we were able to kind of tweak the base bill in Washington State and try to craft it for something that would make a real difference here in Oregon. I want to make sure that there's a very distinct line between House Bill 2043, which is the noxious weed funding, and then this bill, House Bill 2535, which I believe does provide a lot of support to that effort, as we do consider how we're going to support our pollinators and support the agriculture industry as a whole. Obviously, both bills are fantastic ways to do that, but distinct funding sources is what we're looking at here. And I actually have something to share with you all. In Washington State, when the bill passed, they created these little native seed packets that beautify, and I can pass it around after we get through. I'll pass it to you. But in Oregon, we saw an opportunity to partner with some of the nonprofit groups and some of the for-profit private industry who have already been doing a lot of work in this realm. And so you'll see in House Bill 2535, I believe it's Section 4, Sub 2, a private funding mechanism. And you have a representative from Bayer in the room, and they've just released a grant program that you're going to see referenced in other people's testimony. But I think that there's a lot of opportunities for the state to leverage those private investments and really support this effort while hopefully not creating a very large budgetary impact, because we all understand what we're looking at this budget cycle. So you're going to hear from a lot of fantastic people here. I just wanted to provide a little bit of the background. We look forward to continuing to work with Representative Reardon on this bill and seeing what we can do to support the industry. So, and I've got very robust testimony that was passed out with regard to exactly what bees need from a nutrition standpoint, if anybody's really interested. So, thank you.
Chair Klum.
Yes.
I just wanted to add one thing. When we had our task force, we talked a lot about the many things that affect the bee health. Mm-hmm. And I just want to mention just a couple of them, because I think this is just one of several. But, you know, there are pests, there are pathogens, there are viruses, there's pesticide exposure, bee management practices, lack of genetic diversity. But one of them, it seemed like it's really a no-brainer, if you will, to do is to provide good forage for them. And I think replacing the noxious weeds, providing good pollinator source of food just makes abundant sense. And so that's why I wanted to bring this bill to you.
So. Yes, Representative Beretta.
Yeah, it seems like noxious weeds are almost an insurmountable task in itself to get rid of. And then we would be replacing them. I could see it if the replacement kind of overtook them and kind of suppressed them. But what did the bees do before we had the noxious weeds? I mean, if you're talking about spending dollars to replace these, you know, and bees were around before the noxious weeds, I'm just wondering how they survived beforehand.
I'm not the scientist here, so I relied a lot on the folks down at Oregon State at the Bee Center when we had these discussions. So anything I said would only be speculation.
We do have a couple beekeepers coming up here after that. We might check with them too.
And Chair Clem, Representative Barreto, you also have OSU Extensions that their new bee specialist in the room, who mm-hmm. probably would be able to help answer that question, and who also has been doing a lot of work on the vero mite issues.
Okay, Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. Good morning. Question. In regards to 2533, there was when were the fees increased?
Chair Clem, Rep. Brocksmith, that would have been as a result of the 2015 bill, House Bill 3362.
Follow-up. Thank you. If we're having a pollinator crisis, why are we increasing fees on the pollinators?
Chair Clem, Rep. Brocksmith, we're not really increasing this fee. We're actually taking one of the fees away. So one type of hive was inadvertently included. It's one that does not produce honey, and therefore we feel it should not be charged a fee for doing that. So the whole idea was to generate a fee from hives that are producing honey. The nucleus colonies do not do that.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else for the moment? Great. I will say that when I first got here now a while ago, I remember in the spring we were in Ways and Means and the scratch broom were out, and I came back from a weekend trip just very agitated, mostly because my wife was extraordinarily agitated, which transferred to me being very agitated and about it. And, you know, what are we going to do about this? And I remember the answer at the time, to some extent, was it's so far gone, we need a biological agent that would help. Of course, you got to make sure that biological agent doesn't trigger more problems. But I know they it might have been a very honest answer, but I didn't like hearing that. Like, it's too late. What are you talking about? And so I started thinking about prison labor and what else, you know, what can we do to rip all this stuff out? But at least here you'd replace it with something good. I was just trying to get rid of it because I didn't want to have to look at it every spring. And I know it's out there, but when it's yellow and it's so obvious, it really gets on your nerves.
Well, Chair Clem, I share your spousal challenges.
Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, there is a biologic agent that is exceedingly effective. I think it's a beetle. County weed control made applications in my neighborhood, and it knocks Scotch Broom down like you can't even believe. I mean, it's like rocking good. So
I think they were, this about 10 years ago, they were talking about a beetle as a potential up-and-coming thing.
I'm telling you, it knocked it, it knocked it out.
Chair.
Representative McEwen.
Chair Clem, I think in my district this actually becomes a workforce issue because we have a whole lot of high school kids who spend a whole lot of time in the spring pulling Scotch Broom, and you're going to put a whole bunch of kids out of work.
You know what? Why don't we send them down to pull out all the gorse that your ancestor once put into band?
That's harder. You have to wear gloves.
Actually, given I worked the weed crew for, during the summers at the school district, that was a job, a good job.
It is an incredibly, and you know, all kidding aside, it is an incredibly difficult issue. Scotch broom and gorse are huge problems. And if there is a biologic representative wit, my husband will be investigating that because we spent an inordinate amount of time trying to deal with scotch broom.
Yeah.
Huge problem. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, too, for coming up. Jenny, you're now covered for both bills, too, right? Okay. So let me get some of our bee folks up. Ralph Rodia, the state beekeepers, and Harry Vanderpool. Okay. And did Anthony, did you want to testify, or are you just here as a technical resource?
I couldn't do either.
Okay.
I think I submitted something.
Okay. Well, let's see if we get how we do here. Okay, please, gentlemen.
Yes. Chairman Clem, members of the committee, my name is Ralph Rodia. I live in Salem. I'm a member of the Oregon State Beekeepers Association. And we're in favor of this bill because we strongly supported the assessment of fees at the last, in the 2015 session. Beekeepers feel we have a responsibility to help fund for pollination and honeybee research. And so we actually requested that bill in 2015. Unfortunately, the way the bill was drafted was based upon existing language in part that simply defined bees, a colony of bees, as any box that bees are put into. Well, unfortunately, nucleus colonies, which are used to produce the larger colonies, don't produce any kind of honey or any kind of product to speak of other than queens and bees to add or make up a new colony. Well, Department of Justice, unfortunately, I say unfortunately, was asked whether the current law as written covers nucleus colonies, and they said yes, and therefore Department of Ag should be collecting a fee on nucleus colonies. Well, that was never the intent of any of the stakeholders, so we're here today to ask you to help make changes to 602 and 602 to make sure that nucleus colonies are not covered by the fee and the registration. Any questions?
Let's take our other testimony.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Representatives, I just wanted to kind of give a couple of examples to make this a little more clear.
I need to have you say your name for the record,
Harry
please.
Vanderpool, President, Oregon State Beekeepers Association.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Chair Clem, so all of my bees right now are in California pollinating almonds, and as soon as they come back, I will make small divides from them to start new colonies for the colonies that died in the fall. And what I'll use is a small bread box size hive called a nucleus hive. Huh. I'll just move out a few frames of bees into those nucleus hives that are now stored in a storage room, introduce the queen, let that grow, and then those frames of bees, when they have grown some, will be introduced into a hive and restart a hive. So, you know, I could start 100 of those that will eventually go into full-strength pollinating hives that will be out in production this year and be assessed on those pollinating hives. But as the DOJ had it, they would also assess the nucleus hive that I started. So I'd be double assessed for those hives. Nucleus hives are a tool in beekeeping. And that's all a nucleus hive is. But as stated in statute, any vessel containing a hive of containing bees is a hive. That necessitated this bill to exempt nucleus hives from the assessment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any questions for these two gentlemen? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just can't help. Just curiosity's got the best of me. Does Scotch Broom honey taste good at all or not?
From a marketing standpoint, probably not. Yeah. Like clover honey.
It would have to be renamed.
Horse.
Yeah.
Representative Witt, Chair Clem. To go around your question and answer an earlier question is, what did we do before? What did we do before? We had Scotch Broom, blackberries. Oh. Honeybees are not native to the United States, and neither is Scotch Broom. Hmm. So there's that answer for that.
Should have built a wall.
Yeah, Scotch Broom does not produce
but we like the honeybees.
Pollen for the bees. So.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thanks for coming down to talk to us about these bills. Okay. And I'm going to have Jeff Stone, Scott Dahlman, and Mark Nystrom come up and talk about 2535. And then I think, Andy, I will have you get ready to come up after that because we do want to hear a little bit more, particularly about the mortality this year. But I'll do these three first and then you right afterwards. Okay. 2535 is what I have you gentlemen signed up for. And Jeff, I've got you signed up first. Whatever order you like.
We'll just go in order. So it's easy.
Okay.
All right. Despite the shuffling of the chairs, Chair Clem, members of the committee, Scott Dahlman, Policy Director with Oregonians for Food and Shelter, speaking in support of House Bill 2535 today. I want to stress that all of us are concerned with bee health. Farmers and beekeepers both have a lot of skin in the game when it comes to our pollinator populations, because our farmers in Oregon depend on bees to pollinate many crops, but similarly, commercial beekeepers rely on those healthy crops to optimize their pollination services. So we're all in this together, which is why in 2014, Oregon took a proactive step when it came to pollinator health. In 2014, as many of you probably remember, this committee established a pollinator health task force. The group was tasked with finding collaborative solutions to pollinator concerns. It was a very diverse 10-member board. Both Mr. Stone and myself served on it. It met seven times in 2014 and released some priority recommendations, which we shared with you before. But I would say the biggest thing that came out of that group was that bee health has no simple answers. There's no silver bullet thing that we can change that's going to dramatically turn around pollinator populations. There is a wide variety of issues, including mites, diseases, pesticides, genetic diversity, nutrition, and habitat. And we're thankful that this bill takes a look at the latter two of those, with nutrition and habitat for bees. So also important for our members is control of noxious and invasive species. So we want to get rid of a lot of those invasive species that are out there. But unfortunately right now, when those are controlled, many of them are not replaced with other plants that hold the same type of forage and nutritional value for the bees. For example, Himalayan blackberry is something that we try to control. It also provides very, very good pollinator habitat. But when you get rid of it, it's not usually replaced with something that provides as good a pollinator habitat. So we want to be able to control the invasive species, but still make sure that we're having the habitat we need out there. So this bill allows ODA to establish a pilot program to do that. I stress it as a pilot program, so this is a great opportunity to see if this is something that can work on a broader scale going into the future, but I definitely think it's something that we should look at. We do recognize that funding is always an issue with these types of things. There's lots of things that would be nice to do. I would point out a key part of this bill is that it allows for grant funding to be used. And just this week, actually, Bayer Crop Science announced that they will be doing a Feed a Bee program, and they're offering $500,000 in grants over the next year for projects that increase forage for bees. So there are some programs out there that can help fund it, so don't let the funding be a complete deterrent to you on this. We think it's a great program and urge your support.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Stone. I serve as the executive director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. Nursery industry is one of your biggest sectors of agriculture. We're very much supportive of the tenets that are outlined in this particular bill. A couple reasons. First of all, as Mr. Dahlman indicated, there's been good work that's been done since 2014. You have stakeholders who are well-meaning and dedicated to try to roll up their sleeves to get at some of these vexing issues. You have detailed comments from me before you that I will not, mercifully, I will not read to you. But there are a couple things that I would point out that are significant challenges to pollinator health. First of all, I think it's a great mix, if you really think about it, in terms of eliminating noxious weeds and providing habitat for pollinators. I happen to have board members that serve both on the Oregon Department of Agriculture and the Weed Board. And so this is, they get to talk, we get to talk about having this be a win-win between the two. As Mr. Dahlman indicated, it's not simple about bee health. Nutrition is a significant issue, and so that's why this part is really important. I would also venture to say that the varroa mite is still one of the biggest problems for the bee population. If you think of it, the varroa mite is about the size of this tissue box to the human body. And if you think about a whole bunch of those on you, that is why there's a lot of problems, and there's a lot of ways that you can get at that issue. But I wanted to give you a relative sample size about what the size of a varroa mite is. I usually use a cantaloupe, but I didn't have one today. The last thing in the last part of my testimony, there are three national efforts that the association is very proud to be aware of and also helping to push. My association is starting a Million Garden Challenge to try to get communities to plant more pollinator-friendly gardens. The awesome part is that my industry sells you the very plants in which we can help the pollinators. It's amazing how I converted into this issue. There's the Million Garden Challenge. You have the Bayer Crop Science issue that Mr. Dahlman, the Feed a Bee program. There's also significant research being done with our national association, with our national research funds, also the OAN's personal research funds, about how to get at the pollinator issue. So it's not as simple in terms of just one thing is going to help. This issue often gets devolved into one issue, and that's how I'd have you resist that type of temptation. But we are here to support this. We think it's the right logical move in all the issues that you've seen come before this committee over the last 3 years, and urge your support.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, I am Mark Nystrom. I represent the Association of Oregon Counties, speaking here in support of House Bill 2535. We have the county noxious weed programs. We feel like this would be just another tool in the toolbox for the county programs to access. Over the past several years, we've been aware of the fact that the county noxious weed programs and the state's noxious weed program have been underfunded. This would be another opportunity to inject some life into that program. So along with supporting House Bill 2043, the bill that would provide some funding for them, this is just another avenue in which we can approach that problem. So we urge your support.
Okay. Any questions for these gentlemen? Okay, thank you. And Anthony, can I have you come on up? Okay, so tell us a little bit about, if you have testimony, feel fine, but mites and particularly mortality in this last year that I've come to understand is pretty decent size.
Okay, thank you so much, Chair Clem and members of the committee. Adoni Melathopoulos from Oregon State University. I'm the new pollinator health extension specialist. I've submitted testimony, so you can read through it. But with respect to this year, it's turning out to not be a really great year. Oregon State University, through the Honeybee Lab, has been doing colony loss surveys, which looks at the colonies are lost between October 1st and March 31st, winter loss. And over the past 3 years, that loss has been around 22%. We have not yet issued the surveys for this year, but reports from beekeepers, in addition to the levels of the parasites that Mr. Stone was talking about, leads us to think that we're going to be up around 30% loss, somewhere maybe a little bit less than 30% loss this year, which is a big increase. The additional problem is that it's been an extremely cold, wet year, so beekeepers who've lost colonies are going to try to use this period to build their stocks back up, and they're going to have a difficult time doing that. So there's like two problems shaping up for 2017. But the one thing I do want to mention with respect to the bill is right now, as Mr. Vanderpool mentioned, the bees are all in almonds, and they'll be, from this point on, they'll be trucking around to various crops doing crop pollination, and they really need the month of August to recover. And pollination is a real problem for parasite spread. So, you know, you can imagine beekeepers coming into a crop, very close proximity, spreading the parasite around. And in August, it's their chance to get control of the parasite and build their colonies up. And one thing that I, when I look at House Bill 2535, is the real need to have some good forage in the valley in August, throughout Oregon, actually. There's a real dearth of pollen and nectar sources in August. And this initiative could allow us to experiment and at least report back to the legislature the possibility of taking some of this noxious weed area and converting it into a pulse of pollen and nectar that would appear in the month that I think beekeepers really need it.
Any questions? So do you want to tell us a little more about this mite, this Kleenex box cantaloupe-sized mite?
Yeah, it was introduced from, I think it came in the mid-1980s. It came from, it originated from Southeast Asia and traveled over from Europe. The parasite, it goes after the honeybee, the developing immature honeybees, and it spreads viruses around. And so it goes through cycles. The beekeepers have a number of methods for controlling this parasite, but the problem is, as a lot of small crops here in Oregon, they have had difficulty attracting good chemicals to be able to control the mite, and resistance to the parasite in the bees is very low. So consequently, they've had to really struggle with the ability to control this parasite. And I've heard that in the last, beekeepers are in this constant reinfestation situation through pollination, and so they really have a difficult time being able to manage the mite. But it's not a mite that just, you know, some pests in agriculture that draw a plant down, it will kill the colony. Within a year or two of infestation without treatment, the colony is dead.
Okay. I do recall one of your colleagues coming up to talk about insecticides. I know there may be some bills out there about insecticides. I remember specifically hearing him admonish us that before you start selectively picking an insecticide to ban, you need to know what is next. Because if you think that's bad, and I can't remember even this, what the next was, but he was saying, you know, and I remember commenting, so you're talking about people who are amateur hobbyists who we go to Home Depot and think we're going to buy something and buy whatever's on the shelf. And if one gets banned, and it's gone, we'll buy whatever else is there. So we really need to understand what that next thing that would commonly be used is, to know if it's worse than the one that's currently out there on pollinators. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't remember his name now, but Jeff maybe. But I think he's from the integrated pest management and part of
maybe Paul Jepson, maybe.
Yeah, Paul Jepson, yeah. Not Jeff. Yeah. Paul Jepson, yeah. Okay, well, we will probably talk more about bees in future years, but I think we're done for now.
Thank you.
So, he is on his way to the building.
Okay.
I don't know if you want to do work sessions.
Yeah, why don't our Representative Vile is not quite here yet, and so we might just take a pause on these public hearings and do work sessions, if that's okay. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2535 and 2533. and open a work session on, let's do the ODA bill, so ODA could leave and not be nervously sitting back there wondering what's going on as usual. Let's do the dietary supplements. So let me open a work session on House Bill 2256. And do you want to join us for a second, Lisa, just so we can ask you if we have questions? We've got a dash one amendment, and again, this was trying to get dietary supplement language for the state of Oregon to align with the federal dietary supplement language. All right.
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Good morning, Committee. So you are correct. The purpose of House Bill 2256 was to provide ODA clear authority to regulate dietary supplements like a food, which align with what FDA does. We've asked for an amendment to address basically wording issues that came as concerns from the federal organization. The amendment that's been provided in the dash ones does that and was worked on collaboratively with that organization. So with that, I will pause and see if there are any additional questions.
Okay. Any questions about these dash ones? Okay, how about a motion?
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the dash one amendment dated 2/13/17.
Vice Chair Springer moves to adopt the dash one amendment dated 2/13/17. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2256 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
The Vice Chair Springer moves House Bill 2256 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Okay. Any objection to putting this one on the consent calendar? Or should we haze Representative Brock Smith without him knowing it and just assign? Oh, I said that out loud.
I think consent to count.
Consent calendar. Okay. We'll add this to the consent calendar. And then let's open a work session on the, this is Representative Wilson's bill, House Bill 2364. And again, colleagues, you may recall this was the one where we created this mediation program at the same time somebody else was repealing part of it, and we need to correct the statutory, that those few words, just to get it so the mediation program would be useful again. And
so, what bill is that?
2364.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2364 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Springer moves House Bill 2364 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Okay. I think we should test whether Representative Wilson can beat the record held by former Representative Jefferson Smith for the fastest carry. It's like 2 seconds, a 2 second carry. But here's the rules. You can't just say good bill should pass. You actually have to explain the bill to the point where no one asks any questions about it. And Representative Jefferson Smith did it in like 2.7 seconds one time. So that's my challenge to Representative Wilson. This is what happens at the end of session, usually when you're bored and you're trying to get through them very quickly. But we could try it on Representative Wilson. See, it's only one word, so I'm hoping it doesn't turn into a long floor discussion.
Mr. Chair, the problem with that is Representative Wilson speaks much slower.
And he's got that deep voice, so it's going to be a little tricky to get it in. Okay. Representative Wilson will carry. Then I've got some, I think the last committee bills to ask you to introduce, so I won't be bringing any more after this. So I will open a work session. I will tell you about them, too, in a moment. Well, maybe I'll tell you about them right now. So LC 6, again, these are just to introduce committee bills. We may or may not ever even see these bills. 1677 has to do with piece rate workers in the sick leave law that was passed. 1924 and 1927 have to do with shellfish populations. And studies with ODF&W. Those are something Representative McEwen has been working on for a while.
Placeholder for shellfish.
Yeah. And then 3643 is appropriations for weed control districts. It also has it would have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And 4273, what is this one? Prohibits introduction of wildlife species. Do you want to tell us about this one yet, or do you want to wait until we actually have a hearing on it?
Well, wait until we have a hearing, but to give you a 30,000-foot view on it, I have some concerns that maybe the U.S. Fish and Wildlife are introducing animals and species in here without consulting with our ODF&W or the commission.
Okay, so those are the one, two, three. I feel like I missed one. No? But didn't we just cancel one, two, three? Four. Oh, yeah, I did the two at once. Yeah. Okay, those are the five LCs.
Chair Clem, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 1677, dated 2/24/17. LC 1924, dated 10/3/16. LC 1927, dated 10/3/16. LC 3643, dated 2/8/17. LC 4273, dated 2/24/17.
Okay, Vice Chair Springer moves. LC 1677, 1924, 1927, 3643, and 4273 introduced as committee bills. Discussion? Any objection? Okay, seeing none, they're introduced as committee bills. Still don't quite have Representative Vile here, but what I could do is just, I think it's like 5 minutes out. So, ODA, do you want to come back to the dais and talk to us about back in the bee world and specifically about... what's the term? Biocontrol. Okay.
Chair Clem?
Yeah, Representative McEwen.
I'm not sure it's germane to this particular hearing, but I'm very intrigued by a comment that Representative Witt made. Could we draw a thread to biologic agents that control scotch broom with this panel while they're up here?
If you know about it, absolutely, because as I said, it was referenced. I didn't know it was working so well, but it's important. Ooh.
Wait, what do we got here?
I feel like maybe you were prepared for me to call you up.
Damn.
It was better than napalm.
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you a little bit about the weed program. Again, I think we were here earlier in February talking about it, as well as some more work that's done in our biocontrol program. And then any questions that you might have about how ODA's programs intersect with House Bill 2535. With me is Dr. Helmuth Rock. He is the director of our plant program area and oversees the body of work that's done around weeds and invasive species or threatened endangered plants, as well as Tim Butler, who manages our noxious weed program. And so, Tim, do you want to talk a little bit directly to the question about biocontrols?
For the record, Representative Clem, members of the committee, again, my name for the record is Tim Butler. I manage the noxious weed program at ODA. And in reference to the question about biocontrols for scotch broom, we have two primary agents that work on scotch broom, and Representative Witt mentioned one of them. It's a seed beetle, seed feeder. And there's also a seed weevil that we have that works on scotch broom as well. So the seed weevil has been out, I think we first introduced that in about 1983. So it's been out there working for quite a while. The seed beetle is more recently in the last decade or so. And we've moved those, both agents are widely distributed throughout Western Oregon and the range of scotch broom. We actually worked with Bonneville Power Administration and moving those, putting them out via helicopter, dropping releases and trying to get them to everywhere that we could to get those out there working. The agents, it's not a silver bullet, but they can control somewhere in the neighborhood about 60% or so of the seed. So that's a help, but it's not going to control existing plants, unfortunately. So we don't have an agent that actually works on the Scotch broom plant itself. So we're continuing to look at possibilities there, but we don't have anything currently. So I don't know if that helps to answer your question.
Does it move on to something else after it finishes the Scotch broom, or does it
No, these agents are very specific to the plant species, and that's part of biocontrol. There's a range of host specificity testing that goes on to make sure that those agents are specific to that particular target weed. And so they do basically starvation tests and make sure that those agents won't work on something else. And so that's part of the approval process that they go through, very rigorous.
Suicide mission.
They will just die if they don't have the target weed to feed on.
Hmm. No. Okay, what else do we need to know?
So, Chair, Clem, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. For the record, my name is Helmut Rock. I'm the director of the Plant Protection and Conservation Programs area. And in my capacity, I'm responsible for the insect program, the noxious weed program, and the native plant conservation program. And this in reference to House Bill 2535. So we are uniquely situated to address the issues mentioned in the House Bill 2535. Oregon Department of Agriculture, as you heard, has a longstanding experience in noxious weed, so we know how to combat, how to manage, how to monitor for noxious weed. We also have been working for decades with invasive pests, insects. And if I may, I can answer here another question from Representative McEwen about gorse. We're also looking into biocontrol of gorse. We have a moth and mites that we're working on, then, so maybe down the road we have some solution for gorse issues at the coast.
Redemption in sight, Chair Clem. Thank you.
So this all depends, as we mentioned, I think, in an early hearing, we lost our almost 30-year biocontrol scientist, so we're struggling to replace that position. But the biocontrol program is one of the most recognized biocontrol program in the country and is also internationally recognized. So we also have a small native plant conservation program that would be able to collaborate in that House Bill 2535. We know how to look for native plants. We have propagation of native endangered, threatened and endangered plants. So all three programs, the insect, the noxious weed, and the native plant conservation, have a lot of experience and expertise to work in House Bill 2535 to reach the goals that are addressed in that bill. Thank you.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Over where I am, we have yellow star thistle. And about 20 years ago, it seems like they introduced a bug to right down below our house to see if they couldn't control it. And we haven't seen many bugs lately, and I was just wondering if there's any progress on that.
Representative Clem, Representative Barreto, thank you for the question. Yes, we have, I don't recall right off the top of my head, but I think we have like four or five agents that actually work on yellow star thistle. And those, again, are released in most areas where yellow star thistle exists. And we have seen some control in some areas. Again, it's not and that's the thing with biocontrol, it's not necessarily a silver bullet trying to control some of these things, but it can slow it down. We have had some successes, particularly with yellow star thistle in some areas, down in southern Oregon, down in Douglas County in particular. And I think some areas up in your part of the country, too, in northeastern Oregon as well. And I could get maybe some more specifics on that if you're interested.
Yeah, I would. You know, when I first got there, you know, they were spraying with Tordon, and then they decided Tordon was pretty rough stuff, and then mm-hmm. it went to something else, and now it's Milestone. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you have to, and these herbicides are not cheap, you know, but if you could buy a little box of bugs, you know, and start spreading them out instead of the spray, I think there's probably a lot of us would like to try that. So.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's. I think that's a very valid point. I think certainly we look at managing most of these, you know, all of our noxious weeds from an integrated management perspective, and there's lots of tools in the toolbox, biocontrol being one of those, and so it's usually a combination of tools that are needed to, in order to bring these things under control and try to keep them in check.
Okay. Representative Brock Smith.
With regard to, good morning. With regards to the biological managers, and let's talk about the Scotch broom managers, and they eat the seeds. So are there studies, and then of course they die, is what you said, if they don't have the. Is there other studies that you can speak about where there are similar biological management going on and adaptation has occurred, and so that they don't just die anymore and they find another food source?
Chair Clem, Representative Brock Smith, I've worked in the largest biocontrol program in the world in Africa. That's where I did my PhD. So biocontrol, there's different ways to look at biocontrol. In the case of noxious weed biocontrol, we have a very vigorous system how to vet, if we want to use that word, biocontrol agents to make sure that they don't do what you just described, that they, once they have run out of food, that they move on to other plants that could endanger our natural resources or agricultural resources. So this doesn't happen. We are working closely with the federal government on that. We have scientists working on all that. So these biocontrol agents are selected, and they are very specific, sometimes species-specific, for that target that we are looking for. So it happened in past, like in Australia, they introduced a big toad to eat caterpillars, and it ate anything but that caterpillar, and it's becoming a big issue there. But this was in 1930, so we've learned quite a lot since then. And so if I may, Chair Clem and members of the committee, I handed out some, took the opportunity to hand out some stuff. So this highlights also a little bit the expertise that my insect group has on native bees. We're one of the only ones in the state actually working on native bees, on native pollinator bees. So this would also fit in the requirements of 2535. We have over 500 native species here in Oregon, and as you heard from the Oregon's beekeeper president, the domesticated honeybee is not native to North America. It was introduced 400 years ago, and so that's why before we had native bees, and that's what we are looking, because very few scientists are actually looking for native bees and what the relationships are with native plants. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. You also did an admirable job of filling some time for us, and Representative Viles now here. So, not that we didn't want to hear about bees, we just weren't sure we're going to have time or not. So, thanks for being ready and helping us fill our day. Representative Vial, let me open the bill, your bill, House Bill 20, open a public hearing on House Bill 2214. Do you want to bring anybody with you? You just want to tell us about it? Okay. Yep.
Chair Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Rich Vile. I'm the representative, House representative for House District 26, Shoals, Sherwood, Wilsonville, South Hillsboro. I'm here today to talk about the idea of expedited permitting. The bill that you have before you is actually designed to simply fund something that's already in place, but because the local jurisdictions haven't had the money to really act on it, hasn't gone and done what it was intended to do. What the expedited permitting concept was originally intended to do is encourage quicker approvals at the local level of things like high-density housing in areas where Metro, for example, is encouraging higher-density housing, to encourage low-income housing in areas where that need has been identified and where developers were willing to put the low-income housing in. If developers were willing to do that, the current law allows them to ask the local jurisdiction to waive some of the requirements that would lead to potentially appeals on the land use approvals, et cetera, and expedite the approval. The local jurisdictions aren't very happy about that because they don't have any money to do that with, and it does take a higher level of staff effort to do so. All this bill would do would to create a funding mechanism that would allow local jurisdictions to get some more money to do that with. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Chandler, who's here on behalf of the homeowners.
Thank you, Representative Vile, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here on House Bill 2214. By way of background, Representative Vile walked you through some of it. The expedited land division process has been on the books since 1995. Under normal land use procedure, a city or county has 120 days to process a development application from the time a completed application is filed to the time a final decision is made. And that gets honored in the breach some of the time. But for the most part, everybody tries to play within that framework. In the mid-90s, we had a housing problem on our hands. In that case, it wasn't affordability as much as it was the density that our plans assumed. And so we worked on this legislation then, along with the City of Portland and others, to create an expedited process. And what the current expedited law says is a project that comes in with 80% or more of the base density, in other words, an 8-unit project in a 10-unit zone, or, and we changed that, you this body voted on this a session ago, expanded that to also include affordable housing, which is defined in the law now by as anything 120% of median income or below. So if a developer brings in a high-density project or an affordable housing project, they can qualify for this expedited treatment. The expedition is significant. Instead of 120 days, it becomes 63 days. There is no appeal to LUBA at the end of it. It's basically Administrative Procedures Act appeal to an arbitrator who's going to tell you whether or not somebody forgot to disclose an proper relationship. It really does fast-track projects that the state has identified as being important because of our land use system density is obviously something that we're trying to achieve, and because of the housing crisis afflicting many jurisdictions in Oregon, affordable housing is something we're trying to achieve. As Representative Vile indicated, though, that does create a burden on local governments. It is if you're taking a process that used to take 4 months and jamming it for 2 months, that takes more staff time. The same level of analysis has to occur. The same examination of the local comp plan and zoning ordinance has to occur. It does create a burden. What this bill is intended to do is, frankly, to, and you're going to hear this a lot on various issues throughout this session, which is regrettable since we seem to be short of money, according to the newspapers, things the state thinks that are important, the state ought to help pay for. And in this case, the state has identified something they think is important and told the local governments, go do the best you can. That's kind of cheating. This is intended to address that and provide a fund to which local governments could access to actually implement issues that the state has identified as important, i.e. density and affordability. We think it's a good bill, and I think it would have a salutary effect at the local level, and we commend it to you for passage. We'd be glad to take any questions.
Questions for our colleague, Mr. Chandler? Okay. So right now sets up the fund but puts no money in it. Okay. Okay, great. And then I've got one more. Aaron, do you want to come up and...
If I may, Mr. Chair, yeah. On a previous bill you talked about short testimony. I just want to mention to the committee as part of the ongoing challenge. Last session, Representative Gilliam carried a bill of mine on the House floor in haiku. So I would just simply add that to the list of possible items for your consideration.
Not a bad idea.
He would.
Okay. Aaron, tell us what you think of this concept.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Aaron Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I'm going to paraphrase some John Chandler testimony. Good bill, should pass. to expand, the expedited land division process does cost more. It does cost more in staff time. We are able to try to do our best to estimate how much that costs and charge that cost. But when we're looking at affordable housing, it might be beneficial to have not increased cost to those folks building and developing that affordable housing. And the other piece of this bill that is, I think, very important is the portion that talks about also providing grant funding toward the building of infrastructure, which is actually one of the major cost drivers of housing in general. That infrastructure piece helps offset the costs, which are currently either recouped through SDCs, property taxes, user fees, other things that cost those that are trying to develop the houses. And it's one of the areas that I've heard mentioned time and again when we're talking about the ability to develop houses at all price points. And if we can cut that fee by $10,000 per household, that's a pretty significant chunk of change for those that are trying to do the development. So once again, good bill, should pass. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Escobar.
Yes, not necessarily a question, but I think that maybe we could reevaluate what we're doing in municipalities for time frames and layering of different issues when it comes to permitting process. An example of that is in the city of Medford, where I come from. It takes about 12 months, 9 to 12 months to annex a piece of property into the city. Yet you go to Central Point, it's 2 months. And it's just layered upon layer of bureaucracy that is meaningless, a lot of it. So I think it'd be a good evaluation for the municipalities to pursue this and find and ask the question, what does this actually do?
You can pass that along to some of your municipalities.
I will do that.
Okay, anything else for Aaron? Can you move that? All right, I'm going to close the public hearing. That's it. Nobody else here on this one. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2214. And I think that completes our business for the day. This might be the last time we actually get out early. Thank you, everybody, for your attention. And we'll see you in a little while. On the floor, you know, I will mention, well, I can do it off the record. Let me close the adjourn. So Nellie's off the record. Let me close the adjourn.